Want to create your own natural holiday oasis? Well, we've got the answer. Avocado Green Mattress products transform your home into a peaceful grounding retreat. They're made with certified organic and sustainably sourced materials. Avocado is better for you, better for the planet. From breathable bedding to handcrafted mattresses, Avocado is all about true comfort, so you can rest, recharge, and wake up refreshed all season long. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words, very loosely taken from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. I'm GTR of The Nation magazine. This podcast is sponsored by The Nation and widely available in all podcasting platforms. Today, the particular monsters I want to take up are actually very apropos of Gramsci. They're the sort of grandchildren of the monsters that Gramsci worried about. I'm talking about the European populist, so-called populist right, the sort of people who take up anti-system politics and have made real headways in Europe as they have in the Western Hemisphere. And I can't think of anyone better to talk about this than my guest, David Broder, who is European editor of Jacobin, author of a book called Mussolini's Grandchildren, which is about fascism in contemporary Italy, and who wrote a very fine piece in the New York Times about both the rise of anti-system right-wing politics in Europe, but also more crucially, the role that centrist governments have played in trying to fend it off unsuccessfully, and perhaps in some cases, planting the seeds of their own destruction. So first of all, David, very happy to have you on the program.
Hi, G. Well, thanks for inviting me. I'm very glad to be here.
So, yeah, I mean, let's just take a broad survey before we look at like specific countries. So I mean, like, how would you describe the sort of, you know, broad parameters of what is happening in European politics right now?
Well, I start the piece by saying that about 10 years ago, there was a lot of discussion of the idea of this sort of wave of populist electoral upsets. I challenged the language of populism, but there was this idea of, you know, after the financial crisis, voters are unhappy and they're choosing to protest vote. So there's this kind of moment of electoral upsets. So, of course, combining things also like Trump's first election, Brexit, some of the advances for the Front National in France and so on. And in a certain sort of liberal centrist telling, this moment produced many sort of horrible episodes. But then kind of with the pandemic, people looking for sort of secure, reliable, competent government, then, of course, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, people got frightened and the populist wave started to ebb. A lot of these parties actually did suffer some electoral setbacks, including, for example, the Alternative for Germany. Marine Le Pen never, you know, actually made it to be president. So there was a certain kind of reassuring narrative, the grown-ups are back in charge. Also because of Biden coming into power, Olaf Scholz winning the German election in 2021, Keir Starmer's election in Britain. So from a certain sort of centrist standpoint, the tide might have been seen to ebb. And now what we're seeing is that they're wrong, right? This wasn't just a single moment. It's not just a protest vote. Far-right parties are across Europe, including in its richest countries and the ones which are most central to the European project, these far-right parties have established themselves as a permanent part of the, at least, electoral scenery, right? In countries like Germany and France, as well as ones like Italy, they're getting, you know, a quarter or a third of the vote. And now, backed by Trump back in charge, of course, promoted by Elon Musk and so on, these parties kind of seem closer to power than ever. And it's not just on the periphery of the European Union, it's in some of the core countries. So this leads to a discussion, of course, is, you know, how radical and destabilizing actually are these parties? Are they just going to be kind of integrated in a way that, for example, many pundits would say the Italian far right has been, into a kind of systemic politics of, you know, European Union membership, supporting NATO, supporting Ukraine, and so on. So what I'm really questioning is whether these parties' acceptance of these institutions, the fact that they're seeking to play a role in them, shows that they've been sort of defanged and de-radicalized, or whether there's actually something deeper going on in terms of the direction of those institutions. Because, you know, as some of your listeners may have guessed from my accent, I'm British myself. And often, after the Brexit vote in 2016, a lot of people thought the kind of model for far-right parties might be to try and lead their own countries out of the European Union, right? To splinter the EU, to go off in a nationalist direction. And I think what we're actually seeing instead now is something different, which is that these parties, like Marine Le Pen's Front National, like the Alternative for Germany, like Giorgia Meloni's party in Italy and so on, they're actually looking to change Europe from within and are succeeding in doing so. They're succeeding in pushing their own policy agenda also onto more mainstream conservative forces and getting policy wins, including on things that are core planks of the European project, such as the green transition. So I think, you know, compared to maybe 5 years ago, when it might have seemed that the European Union leaders had sort of learned some of the lessons of the post-financial crisis period, that it was sort of politically more stable, I think that kind of idea of a return to normal is now seriously in trouble. And if we look at the cases of France and Germany, traditionally the two sort of main powers in the European Union, in each case the ruling sort of centre to centre right forces are doing pretty badly.
Yeah, no, I mean, it might be useful to like look at each country on a sort of case by case example, and I think that maybe France is a good place to start, because I do actually think, you know, like coming out of Trump's first victory and Brexit, the victory of Macron in France was initially hailed as, you know, like showing like, you know, that centrist liberalism could still speak to the issues of the time, could still rally the population against the threat of the right and be victorious. But, you know, like approaching nearly a decade after that, I think Macron's project considerably less successful. So do you want to like just what's happening in France?
Yeah, I mean, for a certain type of observer, Emmanuel Macron was the sort of ultimate in sort of anti-populism, centrism, bringing together the best of left and right, and was seen as a sort of disruptor of the party political system, which in a way he was in his first election. But I think that, you know, looking more closely at what's really happened is that he managed to unite around himself, to begin with, both parts of the centre-left and centre-right establishment, partly using a sort of certain version of electoral anti-fascism warning against Le Pen. But, you know, his vision that he set out when he became president was, I'm going to undermine the support for Le Pen by answering the basic grievance that she's tapping into. Yeah. And Macron, in a sense, correctly understood that the fundamental reason for the success of the populist right or far right isn't just about identity or immigration, but more fundamentally rooted in a kind of loss of confidence in the future, in institutions, in the future of prosperity. And Macron had his own idea of the way to go about solving that, which was to use his presidency to start to dismantle the previously existing French social model at a faster rate even than previous governments, right? So he promised to make France, in a famous phrase he used, of course Macron often says one thing and the opposite as well, but he said it fairly consistently. You know, he tweeted in English, he wanted to make France into a startup nation, right? Mm-hmm. So what he understood, which I think is correct in an abstract sense, is that the way to deal with the Front National wasn't to sort of meet them halfway or meet their demands, but actually to show through his leadership that there actually was a better path to prosperity. Okay, so his solution was basically cut back the welfare state, free up wealthy France by cutting wealth taxes, and these sort of ultra free marketeer recipes would like unleash a spirit of creative dynamism, get the economy moving upwards, and then people would see that actually centrist mainstream politics does have the solutions.
Yeah, I know. And I should mention that he's working in a specifically French context and trying to harness this kind of like, you know, Gaullist tradition of the president as a figure that is beyond left and right, that stands for the nation, that can be a kind of leadership figure. And so that's also part of the program of creating a new dynamic futurist vision of presenting himself as the, you know, Jupiter who presides over this country.
Well, exactly, because of course what he was actually promising was to enact reforms that he knew people wouldn't like, and which in they said, you know, it's not like people often accused Tony Blair in his day of like ruling by focus groups. Macron explicitly said he was going to do was administer painful reforms that people wouldn't like, but then they'd see the positive benefits and reward him electorally. And then the reality is that, in particular, the cutting tax for the super wealthy has not sort of magically generated growth. As it happened, of course, the pandemic era spending by the French state, which was far less of a recipient of kind of EU funds, or the French state had to pay a lot more for its own sort of post-pandemic recovery plan, which also, of course, wasn't just like some sort of welfare distribution scheme, but was a spending to prop up private business. That has massively increased the French state's budget deficit and therefore its debt. And so now we're in the position where, even after implementing a whole bunch of austere reforms that didn't work, Macron is pushing for even more cuts to social welfare in the name of balancing the state budget, at the same time, of course, as massively expanding military spending, not without a good reason from the perspective of important French business interests, France being one of the world's leading weapons exporters. But, so what we are essentially in is a situation where a government which delivered its program with a kind of performative arrogance and sort of know-it-all attitude, completely ignoring protests from the left, from unions and so on, faced with its program, has basically continually shed support, and in the process has also started to, and not just recently, really since Macron's sort of narrower re-election in 2022, his government has tried to lean into increasingly kind of right-wing identity politics as its preferred mechanism of competing with the far right. And actually, if you look at the people who are from Macron's camp, who are hoping to stand in the next presidential election against, as the main sort of centrist or centre-right candidate against the Front National, all of them are basically competing to outdo each other on taking anti-immigrant attitudes, talking about civilizational decline, adopting kind of parts of the Front National's program, basically out of the idea that, well, people shouldn't risk it by voting for a far-right party, but perhaps they should try voting for a centre-right politician who says some of the same things, but who's a bit more sort of reliable and businesslike. And so this results in this kind of depoliticization where they basically say that their reason for not agreeing with the Front National ultimately amounts to issues of kind of competence and so on. So, in France, we've already seen a lot of the sort of traditional Gaullist party, the Republicans, increasingly even leading members defecting to Le Pen's party or proposing electoral agreements with it. We've seen a lot of the sort of business establishment, media, and even leaders of private businesses starting to sort of recognize that Le Pen's party is something they can manage and work with. So I think overall, what we've seen is a kind of legitimization of the far right, and we look increasingly to be in a kind of situation where Macron's unpopular policies have both sort of created an open political open goal for the far right through his unpopularity and sort of protests against what he's done in government, yet at the same time, in terms of what might have been the issues on which he'd have fought the far right, actually legitimizing their agenda, meeting them halfway, and even, for example, as I mentioned in the article, even on immigration reform, his government has actually relied on Front National votes in Parliament in order to pass measures to tighten welfare benefits for immigrants. So in many different ways, Macron's presidency, far from sort of undermining the Front National or giving people reason to hope again or stopping them wanting to vote for it. Really, it's been a big process of sort of paving the way for a potential Front National government next time.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's an exceptionally cogent presentation. And I think the pattern that we should pay attention to, which we see elsewhere in Europe and in North America as well, is that the proposal that you can sort of defang the far right by adopting their anti-immigration policies doesn't end up being successful. It just legitimizes their agenda by saying, well, you know, like, this is something that everyone agrees with. The mainstream parties also agree with this. And then, so why, in that situation, if you're unhappy with the status quo, then why would you buy this argument that the mainstream parties will do the far-right agenda more competently, since you don't even trust their competence? So you are basically, as you say, paving the way for the far-right success. How is this dynamic playing out in Germany?
Well, I mean, in, you know, Friedrich Merz, who's now the chancellor, Christian Democrat leader, upon taking over as leader of the party, he in many ways tried to distance himself from the legacy of Angela Merkel, the former chancellor, and so partly sort of playing into the idea that, well, you know, she let loads of Syrian refugees come into Germany and Europe, and that was a mistake, and he would be a more sort of hardline, right-wing, authentically conservative chancellor. And in some ways, it's an approach we've also seen of other sort of mainstream center-right parties attempting to combat the far right by sort of, again, sort of leaning into part of its agenda, talking tougher on immigration, the role of Muslims in European societies, and so on. However, Merz didn't score all that amazingly in the federal election this February. His Christian Democrats, who had been in opposition, came first place in the election, but with only 28% of the vote, and had to make a coalition with the Social Democrats, which even to get so centre-right and centre-left together, another grand coalition where both the sort of historic mass parties who used to add it up, they used to get like, you know, 4/5 of the vote, right? Now, barely half, if that. So the sort of main mass parties, the sort of blocks on which the Federal Republic has always been based since 1949, those kind of center forces or mainstream forces, let's say, are sort of huddling together for warmth in a way which I think also is actually very damaging for even the kind of right-wing project which Merz promised, right? Because ultimately the alternative for Germany, the far-right party, well, they just say, well, this is just yet another, you know, they say the government's left-wing. Because it's got social democratic ministers, right? Yeah. So, you know, the
Well, I mean, I think that sort of national unity government discredits the establishment in general, because it actually confirms the argument of anti-system people on the right and actually on the left as well. It's like the establishment parties, there's no difference between them. They're all in cahoots together. They all have the same agenda. So you're basically verifying the critique of anti-system forces.
Yeah, and I think like what's, and we've seen it also, we've seen this example before, very notably in Italy, which, as you mentioned earlier, is the country where I've worked on most. But the thing is that when there isn't the political contest between the sort of major left and right forces, what that also allows a party like Alternative for Germany to do is to kind of occupy the whole space of opposition.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, so I think like a good example and a good key to understanding this is the popularity of the AfD, Alternative for Germany, in the former East, right? So it's true that the AfD talk a lot about the abandonment of East Germany, the sort of incomplete and unsuccessful reunification of Germany, and they mobilize a certain type of identity politics of Easterners who were overlooked. I think in foreign media, that's often misunderstood as like they somehow want something from East Germany back. Or it's kind of like they're nostalgic for some sort of welfareism or something.
Yeah.
But actually what they're saying is something very different, which is like we want to be as rich as the West. We want the success we were promised but hasn't been delivered. And instead, immigrants are getting that promise, not us. So the AfD as a party actually includes all sorts of different kind of economic claims and positions, but which are, I think we can say, like encapsulated by the idea of a sort of unfair meritocracy, right? We want to succeed in the market. Mm. We want the promise of neoliberalism, but it hasn't been delivered. So in a way, they do exploit sort of resentment at like low wages or the sort of abandonment of services in small town East Germany. But that's also allied to a desire for a more effective free market economy, which is also where they have absolutely no problem with being totally hostile to green policies and so on, which they say are destroying growth. So, and at the same time, I mean, one of the main ways in which centrist parties try to attack AfD is to say, well, they're against remilitarization. Mm-hmm. And we need to build our defenses against Russia, but the AfD are against supporting Ukraine. And yeah, it's true that the AfD are against supporting Ukraine. They're against the sanctions on Russia. And they say that that's the reason why Germany's energy bills are so high. But actually, they do also want remilitarization, right? Mm-hmm. They want European collective borrowing to invest in German military industries. They're all in favor. Mm-hmm. So I think that the advantage they have is that faced with both the major parties sort of failing to satisfy the kind of social demand on which they're historically based, the AfD is able to build quite a broad oppositional coalition of voters. Of course, it's, you know, we should be clear, it's hardly the case that they speak for all or even most working class people mm-hmm. or Easterners, but, you know, and in some groups they are, you know, they have accelerated very quickly, you know, particularly among young men, for example, the AfD is really dominant. So, you know, I think this government and actually even the previous Social Democrat-led governments, you know, have tried to do things like harshening refugee policy, promising more deportations. They actually have deported more people, but it's kind of unable to satisfy the demand that AfD offer, which is a constantly rising pitch of demand for more and more to be done, not only to stop new immigration, but even actually to send back people who already live in Germany and perhaps even people born in Germany.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is one noticeable thing about the whole sort of immigration debate, that the sort of, you know, mainstreaming of the anti-immigration position has just further radicalized the right, that they have upped their demand so that now the cry is remigration. That is to say, the sort of ethnic cleansing of society, including people, you know, born in Germany, or even in the case of Turks, people who's like, you know, might have been in Germany for like several generations now. Mm-hmm. It does seem like the centrist parties, to the extent that they themselves are accepting the framing that we are the upholders of the status quo, and, you know, like we're even willing to ally the center left and the center right together. And this is seeding the ground of an alternative. I mean, it is validating the actual title of the far right party. They are the alternative for Germany because you have, you know, a very narrow kind of status quo that even concedes many of the complaints of the far right by, you know, accepting the idea that immigrants are the cause of social problems, but present themselves as, you know, we're going to maintain or uphold the status quo with competence. And I don't think, like, in the long run, that's a very compelling argument at all. In some ways, it's a discrediting argument.
Yeah, for certain. And I mean, it's the problem is that now we have increasingly the situation where even centre-left parties, including Keir Starmer's Labour Party in Britain, say, well, the problem with the previous Tory government is that it said it would reduce immigration after Brexit and didn't. So there's this far-right, or what was a far-right meme called Boris Wave, which is to say that when Boris Johnson was Prime Minister, he opened up the floodgates for a massive wave of immigration. Right? Keir Starmer himself has used that expression to say, well, you know, the Tories weren't competent, they weren't stopping people coming, and that's what we're doing. And the problem is it's, as there's a good article in The Guardian the other day by Heather Stewart, which talked about this, which is like, well, the problem is that by saying the problem is about stopping people coming is totally dishonest about labour shortages or indeed the reasons why people set off moving in the first place, and just sort of indulges this fantasy that what we could do is just like shut down the borders and stop anyone coming.
Yeah, no, I think this is actually a good occasion to like just take up a broad overview of the United Kingdom, which is like the, you know, other major example, as you're suggesting, where this dynamic is playing along. And it's kind of a curious one, because unlike in Germany or France, where this, the centrist parties are in a sort of a precarious position and have to negotiate. Labor in the UK has like as a super majority. Like they have in a parliamentary system where the governing party, if they have a majority, could like has actually quite a bit of sway. So it's a bit curious to see like in that context, a government that is not governing with confidence but is really sort of flaying. Well, what's your sort of analysis of what's going on there?
Well, I think that people like Keir Starmer or his advisor Morgan McSweeney or Rachel Reeves, who's the Chancellor, these people are geniuses of like internal labor movement machine politics, right? They performed brilliantly in helping to wreck the kind of Corbyn era Labour Party and afterwards ousting the left from the party. Almost without a fight from the other side. They are brilliant maneuverers. They think they're political geniuses. A lot of them are actually people who sort of grew up politically as kind of student activists during the sort of Tony Blair years. So they think that basically the sort of one trick to have amazing electoral success for a left-wing party is to be really right-wing on everything. And so this is kind of confirmed in their eyes by the election result. Only last July, 17 months ago, which was, Keir Starmer won I think the biggest Labour majority in history, right? You have two-thirds of the seats in the House of Commons, right? They did that with only one-third of the vote on what was also a historically low turnout. Since then, they have lost more than
And
half.
they actually got like less votes, or maybe a smaller percentage than like Corbyn had gotten 2 years earlier.
So what they would say, the defenders of Starmer would say, well, okay, but Corbyn might have got more votes, but he also motivated more like anti-Labour votes. Whereas like Starmer's a kind of pragmatic centrist, so lots of people who are quite right-wing wouldn't really care if he took power. And basically the problem is that that mode of doing politics is basically kind of, and it's again, it's a little like the Macron thing, which is like, well, what we need to do is to show that we're really sensible and that, even if we do unpopular things, like, for example, reducing the winter fuel allowance, which helps pay for pensioners' heating, or cutting benefits for disabled people, even disabled people who are working. Those are like tough choices, but also they kind of performatively indicate that we're like careful with the public money. And if we don't invest, if as indeed they have done, if they cut back their plans for sort of green investment, then actually that will pay off in the long run because the bond markets will trust us. And then growth will eventually return. And when growth happens, then people will come and thank us. So the problem with that kind of perspective is, since the election last July, Labour has lost about half of its support in polling. So that in most polls, they aren't even at 20% of the vote. In some, they're as low as like 14 or 15. In response to my article, I'll just say most of the comments on the New York Times website say, well, what I'm saying is that people are voting for the far right because left-wing parties aren't left-wing enough. Like, what an absurd thing to say. My retort to that would be that to say that a party like the Labour Party has to mobilise its own supporters, right? It can't appeal to everyone. So what it needs to do is to mobilise the maximum number of people who are even conceivably going to vote for it. And to do that, it has to show them that it's able to act in their interests and in ways that conform with their moral values and expectations. So, if Labour has lost half its votes in 1.5 years, that doesn't seem to me likely to be because half of its voters have suddenly warmed to Nigel Farage or consider that the main problem facing the country is to slash immigration, so they become far right. Actually, what's happened is that most of them have switched to the Green Party, and also a big chunk of them just tell pollsters that they won't vote anymore. So, what I'm saying is, well, if Labour has, two-thirds of the seat in Parliament, is actually still well into the first half of its term in office, then actually it should be doing radical and bold and progressive and interventionist things, and it isn't. Instead, it's trying to fight against Nigel Farage and reform his party by saying that he kind of has a point, but he says what he says in too racist a way. And actually, as I mentioned in the article, we've also had this very strange thing where Keir Starmer has sort of adopted very sort of tough language in condemning previous Labour governments, including even the Blair government, for example, saying mass immigration had caused incalculable damage to British society. So, or, you know, for example, switching between saying that Farage's party has racist policies and then kind of backtracking. So I think that Labour has sent a very confusing message, which kind of admits half of Reform UK and Farage's point and promises to resolve it in a more competent way, which is essentially to take sort of a showily punitive measures against migrants, so including the latest proposals, which includes things like confiscating refugees' valuables, to show that they're really tough on immigration, while also failing to take the political initiative on other areas where it might build an alternative coalition of support. So, you know, of course they're not going to appeal to everyone, but what they need to do is build political dividing lines and to politicise issues like the economy, like the taxation of the super rich, and indeed, and crucially, the green transition, right? Of course, voters who are drawn to the far right aren't particularly likely to consider that to be their main interest, and action on that isn't necessarily going to win them back. But what a centre-left government has to do is build a coalition of support with interests, with values mobilised around a kind of collective project for the direction the country is going to go in for the next, you know, not even this government, but for decades. And in that, the green transition, green reindustrialization, and also services, jobs connected to that, you know, is absolutely fundamental, and it's just failing to make it an issue. It's not. It's basically just talking about immigration all the time. And so I think that it's shown a real lack of leadership. And while a lot of the sort of press who supported the Starmer project kind of congratulate themselves on how brilliant and competent he is and that all his counterintuitive choices, judging by voters' choices and polling and so on, very few people are buying it.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, it does seem like the strategy by which they won, you know, their very impressive victory was a demobilization strategy, which could only work if you had like an already discredited Tory party whose own voters were discouraged. And so therefore, you know, like running to the center, you know, not frightening the right-wing voters allowed you to win that. But that's not going to be the case forever, especially if, like, you know, the right moves away from the Tories and coalesces around like a more dynamic anti-system party and then presents itself as an alternative. In that case, your strategy of demobilization is not only like ineffective, you're actually like creating all the preconditions for like a victory of the radical right. Like, it just seems like I can't imagine, like, if your actual goal was, you know, to bring a neo-fascist party into power in the United Kingdom, I can't imagine like doing anything more than Labour is doing right now, both legitimizing anti-immigrant sentiment, demoralizing your own voters, purging the left from your party. Like, it all seems like pointing in one direction.
Yeah, because I think, you know, the people like Starmer and so on, they have in their head the Corbyn thing. The Corbyn leadership was disastrous. I would be very critical of it myself in lots of ways. But his perspective is kind of like, well, the thing that worked so far up to the point of election was like punishing the left, attacking the left, showing Tory voters that they needn't be worried about us. So that's what we should keep doing. And yet then, but now the party's at like 18% in the polls, probably even on average.
Yeah.
And so it's like the, you know, certain of the ideas that were very strong on the Corbynite left very much suffered from the impression that they were sort of vague ideas for the future that were sort of technocratic or sort of big white elephant projects that didn't conform to reality. The green transition stuff, I think, very much suffers from this in terms of voter perception as like, oh, it's all very nice to say by 2050 we'll do this, but where's the like practical thing happening now, which shows that this actually isn't a threat to my interests, that this actually is a necessary path to prosperity. And with the majority the Labour government has now, it has an enormous opportunity to take the lead on that and make it real, because it can win every vote it likes in the Commons, yeah. Right? And it's just totally failing to do that, which also guarantees that the issue is going to be buried, because it's now very likely that the next government in Britain will be Nigel Farage and Reform UK. That said, I do think that one of the possible sort of positive exit routes in the British case, more than in the French and German, is like there is a serious possibility that Keir Starmer will fall, and that in a vote among the Labour membership for his replacement, a more left-wing candidate would win. I actually think that given the appalling state of your party, the new party launched by Corbyn, that some sort of recomposition of the Labour Party remains a central, necessary strategic horizon for the left.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I know. I think that makes sense, especially, you know, like within that parliamentary system where oftentimes real politics takes place within parties, not just between parties. So like if there's a change within the Labour Party itself, then things could become very different. But I mean, to sort of like flesh out, you know, the final part of your argument, like it's not just enough to say that these centrist project of the last decade, like, is clearly failing, and you know, in the three of the major European countries look to be on the road to like far right governments, but also to, you know, like map out what a plausible alternative is. And in your article, yeah, you do cite the examples of Denmark and Spain, where center left parties have found a measure of success, not just by co-opting anti-immigrant sentiments, but by offering like real alternative in terms of economic policy.
Yeah. So the So when my editor at the New York Times was asking me when we were discussing this article, I sort of winced at the idea of like finding positive counterexamples because they're not great examples, I have to say, but they're very telling. I think they're telling examples, but they're not just like good model to follow. So the Danish one, I think, is really key because the Danish example is seen by a lot of sort of post-liberal type thinkers. In Britain, we have the Blue Labour current. The Danish example is often held up as a model for the British Labour Party. And actually, in the recent tightening of refugee entrance policy in Britain, Denmark is explicitly cited by the government itself, even on the official government website, never mind as a public media. Denmark is cited as this great example of social democracy that won back the working class. And the story goes a bit like the Social Democrats started losing support to the Danish People's Party, a far-right party, which in the kind of mid-2010s was getting as much as a quarter of the vote. The Social Democrats, led by Mette Frederiksen, pitched hard to the right on immigration in the late 2010s, saying, well, refugees, actually, we don't want to integrate them. They can stay for a bit, but then they'll be sent away again, introducing this kind of performative cruelty, like the confiscating of valuables and so on. So I think a lot of people on the sort of Starmer wing of the Labour Party, as well as the kind of Blue Labour current, which is a one which says, you know, let's win back the working class by being tough on immigration. Something I write about a lot is this kind of increasing tendency to only talk about the working class as a political subject, specifically insofar as it's right wing.
Yeah, yeah.
So as an example of my point, it would be very unlikely for the New York Times to run an article that said that a strike in opposition to a pension reform was an example of working class attitudes. Mm-hmm. Whereas protests against migration are almost always coded in the language of working class, Rust Belt, left behind, all of this. So there's kind of identity politics, which is working class people are right wing and don't want immigration. And deep working class people aren't immigrants. So in Britain, this has become a very powerful force. And this Danish example is used to illustrate it, right? So Mette Frederiksen, she became Prime Minister, Social Democrat in 2019. In 2022, she won re-election with a slightly increased vote. And it was actually a rare case of a Social Democratic Party in power that increased its vote. And the far right greatly diminished, right? They're now in like single figures. So what I'm actually talking about in the article is that I think it's actually a myth to think that the immigration policy is the reason why that happened. Right? It's true that Frederiksen moved much to the right on immigration, that Denmark has a particularly unwelcoming policy on refugees among all European countries. However, if we look at the reasons why voters say they vote, what they said their priorities are, then the top issues in Denmark are inflation, cost of living, climate and energy, right? And Denmark including under Frederiksen's government, particularly her first government, which relied on left-wing party support, Denmark has world-leading and particularly European-leading green transition policies. Right, massively invests in renewables production. Denmark is the biggest oil producer in Europe and has committed to phase out production, is the biggest oil driller in the world, to set a legally binding date on stopping oil drilling. So what I'm saying is actually that those policies, which haven't been politicized in Britain by the Labour Party, actually were decisive in Denmark. In Denmark, in power since 2022, her second government, Frederiksen, has relied on coalition with centre-right parties, actually not unlike the current grand coalition we have in Germany, but it's the other way around. So Social Democrats lead, but with centre and centre-right allies. And her party's support has fallen, and left-wing parties are rising. So I guess what I think is interesting in the Danish example is that while it's often used to illustrate, well, the Social Democrats sapped the far-right vote by being tough on immigrants. But what I see instead is actually that a broad spectrum of parties increased their share and the far right declined because of a change in the economic picture and because of the rising prevalence and interest in green policies. It's also true that there are rising other far right forces who are against the green transition and mobilize around it.
Yeah.
Right? That's inevitable. It's an issue that is bound to be a reason for conflict. But what left-wing parties have to do is to, I think, show that the green industrialization agenda is a necessary part of future prosperity, as well as being fundamental in terms of preserving the conditions for human life. What it has to do is reconcile the demands that that transition involves with cost of living. So that includes all sorts of problems. It's not always easy, but in the Danish case, it's actually a relatively successful example of that in practice.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then I would add also that the green agenda has to be shown to be serving the working class. As you say, like, you know, you will get polarization on this issue. But I mean, it seems like a more favorable battleground to pick your battle to fight on than on immigration. We're sort of running out of time, so we don't have much to say. But maybe like a sentence or two about Spain as well, as a, you know, offering an alternative model.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Spain is also, you know, alongside Denmark, probably in European social democracy, Denmark and Spain are sort of opposite paths, right? Pedro Sanchez, the Spanish Prime Minister, head of the Socialist Party there, is both the longest serving centre-left Prime Minister in Europe and probably also the most left-wing. So the Spanish government, which has also for the last 5 years, almost 6 years, in fact, also included parts of the radical left that came out of Podemos and Izquierda Unida and so on. That government has, through its 7 years in office, has increased the minimum wage by 50%, has capped energy prices, has carried out a major revision of labor law, unlike in other countries, actually undoing previous neoliberal counter-reforms. And, you know, there's a strong bipolar politicization in Spain between a broad left camp and a broad right-wing camp. So unlike other countries where there's been grand coalitions, in Spain, the main centre-left party has allied with forces further to its left, created the first left-wing coalition since, you know, the Spanish Republic that preceded the Civil War. So that government has all sorts of problems, right? Corruption scandals, a very hostile media environment, very hostile and politicized judiciary. But, you know, Sanchez has maintained working class support for the Spanish Socialist Party in a way that's broadly untrue of other social democratic parties in Europe. The general election in 2023, he was widely expected to lose, particularly after the very poor local and regional election results that just preceded it. But he succeeded, I think, because he both sort of warned against the far right threat and Vox, the nationalist party there, but also had a real record of material achievement. Since the re-election in 2023, he no longer has a parliamentary majority. The government's had a really hard time passing a budget, doing anything, really. It's probably been more to the detriment of his left-wing allies than the Socialist Party itself. But I think that it's the Spanish case illustrates what a sort of moderately left populist version of social democracy looks like.
Yeah, no. And again, in its willingness to like at least offer an alternative and to positively polarize on its behalf, very much in contrast to the examples that we've seen in France, Germany, and the United Kingdom. So yeah, I mean, I think your article and what you've just talked about like really does show like that there is an alternative path available and some of the stark choices, and that particularly some of the centrist forces that are presenting themselves as the alternative to the far right are actually doing a service to the far right, or at least, you know, preparing the way for them. There's a lot more we could say about this. I'll link to the article. It's very rich, but we'll have to leave this for now. So once again, I want to thank David for being on the program.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on. I enjoyed the discussion.